welcome to the Media Matters podcast presented by myself, Colette Sexton, news correspondent at the Sunday Business Post. In each episode, we talk to an expert in the media and marketing industry and pick their brain on the topics that matter. This month, my guest is Peter Gagan, an Irish investigative journalist and writer living in Glasgow. Peter was recently appointed investigations editor of Open Democracy, an independent global media platform. He is also co-founder and director of The Ferret, a Scottish investigative platform launched in 2015. Over the years, Peter has reported from countries including Kosovo, Egypt, Zambia, Iceland, Ireland and Scotland for a range of publications, including The Guardian, The Irish Times, RTE, Al Jazeera and The Sunday Business Post. He has also made radio documentaries for BBC, Radio 4 and others. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Colette.
And you're all the way over in Glasgow, so you're coming through to us from Skype right now.
I am coming through Skype line, which I'm sure both of us are hoping doesn't fail at some stages. It almost certainly will.
I mean, I have serious paranoia that only one of us is getting recorded right now, but sure, it'll be all fine. Listen, Peter, explain to me how a Longford man ended up working as an investigative journalist in Glasgow.
That's a very good question. But I guess my background, I am a Longford man, and I ended up in Scotland actually to study. I studied in Edinburgh University, and then after I finished studying, I ended up became a journalist over in Scotland. And I started off actually, I used to write quite a lot for Business Post a good few years ago.
Wow.
And like many young journalists, back in the day, I used to do a lot of, mainly actually stuff from Northern Ireland. But like a lot of young journalists, I started off doing, you know, kind of artsy stuff. My first ever job was as an art, arts critic writing in Northern Ireland, working in kind of arts journalism and writing features and lots of fluffy stuff. I used to write a lot of kind of human interest features and things like that. And as time went on, I started kind of gravitating towards doing more and more investigative work, finding out more information, which kind of in some ways connects to my own belief of where the media industry is going. I guess, you know, if you look at 10 years ago, you could make a living as an arts critic. You know, you could go and watch films and go to theatre and you could kind of create a living for yourself. And there is still some people doing that, but there's far less than there used to be. And I guess because I was so interested in keeping a career going and finding out where's the developments, I started gravitating towards investigative journalism because I think there's always going to be a market for new information. I think it's whether you're a business audience or another audience, I kind of was thinking, well, there's always going to be an interest in finding new information. So I kind of started doing more and more investigative work, and I ended up working for Channel 4, Channel 4 Dispatches, making kind of working on investigative documentaries, half-hour documentaries for television. And from there, I also set up my own kind of investigative outlet in Scotland called The Ferret, which is a cooperative. So basically, it means that everyone who subscribes to The Ferret becomes a member of it. We have about 750 paying members, and we also have grants. We've got 2.5 employees at the moment. We've been going for about 3 years. We've won numerous awards. We just won another award the other night from the Scottish Refugee Council. So that's been quite exciting, quite interesting. And in general, I've been, for the last, say, 5 years, working more and more in kind of investigations and trying to bring new investigative techniques into Scottish newsrooms, but also working kind of a bit more internationally as well. And as you mentioned in the outset, I am living in Glasgow, but I also, my main job is I work for Open Democracy. We're based in London, and I'm their investigations editor. So we do a lot of work on basically around transparency and openness, especially in government. So do a lot of work around freedom of information, but not just freedom of information, also questions about, well, who's paying for politics, who's getting involved in political process, who's lobbying. Lobbying is a big interest of us, and with Brexit coming around the corner very fast, so that's been the B word's been my big word of the year. So that's kind of how I kind of got more and more into investigative work. And it was funny as well, I felt like in a lot of newsrooms I worked, it's probably a lot of journalists I know have had the same experience in daily newsrooms, it can be quite difficult to get the time into space. So I've been quite lucky in the last 3 or 4 years, especially since I went to work for Channel 4 and after that, to get the time and space to spend time looking at stories and trying to bring new information out. Because I think that's the big challenge for day-to-day journalists is to how to make that space, given the amount of content that it's expected of everybody to be able to produce.
Yeah, do you think that there's this kind of race to get whatever content it is up online or wherever, whatever your medium is, and there's less time for thought about what that content is and what it could be?
I think there is. I think it's. I've a huge. Having worked in newsrooms, I worked in newsrooms in Scotland for a good number of years, and having worked on daily newspapers, I have a huge amount of sympathy for daily journalists. You know, people and Sunday journalists like yourself as well, Colette. But
yes,
I have
yes,
a
have
lot
sympathy
of,
for me. It's tough.
It's tough. But you know, the expectation on journalists and the amount of content they're supposed to produce on a given day, you know, I know people who work in newsrooms who are expected to produce 4, 5, 6, even 7 or 8 stories a day. That's a lot of content. It's very difficult, you know, to be across all of that, to be as accurate as you'd want to be. And not just as accurate as you want to be, but to use the language to interrogate in the way you'd want to. And I think, you know, we've got a public who are increasingly aware of how the media is put together, maybe not always correctly, but they're far more media critics than there used to be. There's a lot more media monitoring than there used to be. You just have to go onto Twitter. And I think it's very difficult for journalists who are in that environment, because on the one hand, there's a much kind of higher bar in terms of what you're, I think there is a higher bar in terms of what it is you're putting out, what words you're using, but there's also a kind of a desire and a rush to produce more words than ever before. And I don't know how you can square those two things off against each other. And oftentimes, you know, and I can be guilty of it as well in terms of saying, well, why are you using that word and not using this word? Why are you talking to that person and not talking to this person? But often that can just be a factor of, you know, of expediency, of the lack of time, the lack of kind of ability to spend time looking at critically at a story rather than just saying, well, this story's just come in the door. How do I get it out quickly? And the expectation is, you know, that the content will be produced faster and faster and faster. So I do think it's a very difficult situation that a lot of journalists find them. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's often a criticism of journalists repeating, you know, lines that come from government or wherever else. But probably one of the big factors is the ease at which those lines are delivered.
So do you think that you're kind of privileged in your position now? I mean, between the Ferret and Open Democracy, that you're able to do these investigative pieces where you can stop, take a moment, ask the questions that need to be asked?
Yes, completely. I must say, I do feel incredibly privileged, and I keep on expecting to wake up in the morning and find I don't have a job or something has gone terribly wrong and we're not going to be able to work anymore. Because I do think it's very unusual, really, in this day and age for us to get the time and the space to look at stories in depth, to ask and to look at, to be able to choose what avenues and angles you want to look at, you know, and to be able to say, look, this is where we're going to focus our attention, because there's such a huge scope as well now of potential, especially if you're looking at, say, from the UK context, there's such a huge potential scope of areas and issues of interest that you could look at, and the ability to be able to say, well, look, we're going to choose to look at this and not that. And I guess coming from having worked in investigative TV, I think it's quite a good place to come into something like my current role, in that, you know, in that context, you'd be probably working for 3 to 6 months on a half-hour documentary, and you're going to have the time and the space to really interrogate you, to ask lots and lots of questions, to try and run down all the different leads that you'd want to run down, and which for a lot of print journalists in particular, or daily broadcast journalists, there just isn't the time and space to do that. I guess the big challenge in my role, and for anybody, but especially if you're working for smaller news outlets or news outlets that aren't part of what you want to call the mainstream media, is how to kind of transfer what you do to make it stick. You know, how do you take an investigation that might appear on Open Democracy and give it some stickability, get it into the wider kind of news ecosystem? And one of the interesting things I found is that my role is primarily journalistic, but also part of my role really is bringing out the work that we do and giving it to other news outlets. So I'm always very keen to collaborate with other news outlets. We've collaborated with some news outlets across the political spectrum, everything from like kind of the Eye to the Mail on Sunday, and, you know, kind of trying to take stories that don't just exist in a kind of echo chamber or in a filter bubble, and you're trying to get them out to a wider audience. Because I think that's always a real challenge if you're a smaller outlet, is how do you make these sort of stories kind of speak to something wider? How do you kind of make them interesting to people that mightn't be necessarily interested in, you know, government openness and transparency are all very wordy. It's very what we might call broccoli journalism, but how do you make people care about that? And I guess that's one of the big challenges I kind of face, is to try and think about, well, how do you tell stories in such a way that you can get people to engage with it? I think investigative journalism in general probably still has a bit of a way to go with storytelling. You know, there's a huge, everyone loves, and sometimes, and I use a lot of freedom of information, but it can also be it can sometimes dictate how we tell stories. So stories can become very data driven and not very personal driven, personality driven, or very narratively driven. And I guess that's something that for a lot of investigative journalists is probably scoped to improve how we tell stories so people can engage with them more. Because I think people struggle with figures. You know, if you have a figure, 10,000% increase in X or whatever, it's quite hard
nothing,
for people to actually engage. It does. I think it's, you know, it looks good as a headline and journalists like it, but I think it's very difficult for the public to really engage with that. And I think that's a big challenge for investigative journalists, to kind of show the public, well, why does it matter? You know, you found this piece of information, but, you know, why does it actually matter?
So is that what you're, how do you manage to do that with Open Democracy? Will you give me some examples of how you've managed to do that over the past while?
Well, about 18 months ago, I wrote a story with my colleague at Open Democracy, Adam Ramsey. At the time, I wasn't working for Open Democracy. We did a small investigation into the DUP and their funding for their Brexit campaign, and we discovered that they'd spent over £250,000. And that was a huge sum of money. And so this story initially went up on Open Democracy. But then we kind of thought, one of the things I did with trying to get that story out into the wider world and trying to tell it to an audience that might be interested in it, at the time the story broke, it was just before the snap Stormont election in Northern Ireland, which was precipitated by this renewable heating incentive scheme, which cost hundreds of millions, and the government collapsed. So it was an interesting time. This story came out at the right political moment. So I was able to kind of start to put that into the kind of Northern Irish media world and kind of send it to journalists, send it to politicians. Are you interested in this? That ended up being discussed. It became at a live debate on BBC. It became a key question. Arlene Foster kind of struggled to answer it. Then there was another live interview with Arlene Foster. And the next time she struggled to answer it again. It became a large issue in the campaign. But also what we did as well at a UK-wide level was tell a series of stories around this donation about, well, how was the money used, where people would have seen it, how this money was used in the United Kingdom, not just in Northern Ireland and Great Britain. We went to England to find out how this money had been used to produce various bits of election paraphernalia, and to try and tell an audience that for whom this would just be, sounds like a story about Northern Ireland, that actually it's not. It's a story about the United Kingdom, because it was part of this referendum, which the whole of the United Kingdom was part of. The money was spent, almost all of the money was spent in Great Britain, not in Northern Ireland. So what I was trying to do then was to actually, so people who are reading this could say, well, why does it matter to me? What's the interest in this to me? But I still think I have a way to go with it. I think I don't think we're at the end of that process yet about trying to think about, well, why does this matter? How can you can make this actually something that people can empathize with and care about? It's not just a series of figures, or it's not just something to be outraged about.
Yeah, there is that balance in journalism. Something might be in the public interest, but you also have to make the public interested in it for it to actually have an impact on anything.
Completely, yeah. And I think that's a huge challenge for journalism. You know, if you look at, like, to take the United Kingdom example at the moment, I spent most of the last year doing work around Brexit, some of it to DUP, but lots of other stuff too. And in recent weeks, there's been a lot of focus on a man called Aaron Banks. And Aaron Banks used to be, he's a failed Conservative Party candidate back in the day, a minor donor to the Conservative Party. But then around 2014, he started donating to UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, and he donated over £8 million to the Brexit campaign, which is the biggest donation in British political history. So an interesting character. A lot of people were kind of surprised about this guy, because he came out of nowhere, and this £8 million donation was really huge in British political terms. So I spent a lot of time looking at his background, looking at where his money came from, finding that quite a number of sources of his money did not seem to be worth anywhere near as much as he said it was. He said he'd had these diamond mines in South Africa, and I looked into them, and they didn't seem to have anywhere near the value he was talking about, similar to these mines in Lesotho. And so I've been kind of looking at this guy for quite a while, but in the last few weeks, he's become a big figure in Britain because a story emerged that he'd had a series of meetings with the Russian ambassador that he hadn't disclosed before. And obviously, given the context of Russia, there was a huge interest in that story. But what I found, and the same with the Cambridge Analytica story, which I reported as well, was a lot of the reporting around this, it's quite what you call inside baseball. For people who aren't part of the political world, it's very hard to understand. You know, if you ask the average man in the street, well, what's Cambridge Analytica and what does it do? I think people would really struggle. You know, if you look at that story, the bank story about all this money, a lot of people were like, well, I don't understand this. And partly it's to do with reporting. The reporting was so convoluted, and a lot of different reporters had different takes on it. a kind of no real sense of a firm timeline and a firm kind of set of, oh, this is what we know and this is what we suspect. What we know and what we suspect seem to kind of all kind of meld together. And the same, I think, is true of Cambridge Analytica. Most people, if you ask them about this kind of their accessing of millions, tens of millions of Facebook accounts, were like, well, what did you expect? That was, I think, most people's reaction to that, because I think they hadn't really understood why this mattered. Are the issues around it and the political issues around it and the issues around privacy, etc. And I think that's a real challenge. And I think oftentimes when we write these stories and we maybe have a debate for 5 or 10 minutes on the radio, there isn't a chance to get beneath them. There isn't a chance to really explain them. There isn't a chance, and I think reporters can sometimes struggle to kind of explain these things cogently to an audience. You know, I put my hand up for a mutual friend of ours, Gavin Sheridan, who I think does this job really well in terms of explaining to people why this actually matters. You know, the best journalist and startup founder, Gavin. And I think there's a big...
So we all need to be more like Gavin.
We all need to be more like Gavin in some respects. But I think that's a big challenge for journalism still. I think, you know, if we look in, and I think for some people who look into the UK right now, they go, why isn't there more debate about who funded the Brexit referendum or how it was run and all the rest of it? And I think partly it's because for a lot of people, they've switched off from this story because the story is presented in a way that they struggle to understand. And in some ways, that's a function of the fact that a story breaks and then it starts to develop. I always find this in Ireland, too. Whenever I come back to Ireland and I look at the front page of the Irish Times, I regularly don't understand the main stories. You know, I don't. They're talking about a tribunal. They're talking about some sort of whistleblower. They're talking about something that's been going on and on for a long time, and I don't understand them because I don't live in Ireland. But I'll ask people I know. I'll ask my family, "What's this about?" And they don't understand them either. You know, they've kind of lost touch with what this story means. And I think sometimes, as journalists, we can get really into like, here's the next bit of the story, but there's a need to explain.
To bring the audience along with you.
Yeah, to bring the audience with you in a way that they can understand why this matters and they can kind of empathise with it.
Yeah, like I remember the whole rigmarole when Web Summit decided they were pulling out of Dublin, and someone I know in my family rang me and said, "What's Web Summit?" And I was just like, "Thank you," because I needed that clarity. I mean, everyone in the media was all constantly going about Web Summit, and like at the face of it, it's just a conference in Dublin. Like when I explained that, I was like, it just shows how insane we are going over this thing that isn't really that big a deal in the grand scheme of things. Peter, in terms of picking a subject, how do you decide what investigation to go after?
I think that's a very good question. I think it often is context dependent. I found a lot of the work I've done over the last kind of 18 months has led on from one bit to the next. I wouldn't have expected 18 months ago that I'd spend most of my time, the last 18 months, looking at issues around, say, the Brexit referendum. You know, that story came very much out of just this one story about the Democratic Unionist Party and this £425,000 donation from an anonymous donor. And that came actually, my interest in that story came from the fact that I knew that Northern Ireland had donor secrecy, that the political donations in Northern Ireland were secret because of the legacy of the Troubles. And it had been something I'd been interested in for a while. So that's how I became interested in that story. And that kind of spun out into looking at Aaron Banks, looking into Vote Leave. I spent a lot of time looking at the official Leave campaign, and I discovered some spending irregularities there, and there's actually the Electoral Commission in the UK is going to adjudicate in the next kind of week or two about that, and it looks like they're going to find them guilty, as they've already found Aaron Banks of breaking UK electoral law. And in many ways, that this is kind of a product of just, you know, once you start looking at one subject, other avenues start to open up. And most of my work at the moment really has just sprung out of that, really out of one story, and just spun off because so many of these issues are linked. You've got other, you know, groups, lobbyists who are linked up to the political process. You've got the wider question of what's going on in government. So there's a lot of kind of related issues. So I guess that's, in this respect, in this area, most of my work has been guided by just kind of moving on as the story develops and finding and seeing new interests and new avenues. And more generally, though, when I work, say, I work with the Ferris as well in Scotland, we do a lot of what we, I guess you call public interest investigations. And that's slightly different. Sometimes in that, because we're kind of a member-owned cooperative, we often ask our members what they want us to look at within a broad parameter. So we'll ask our members, you know, to vote on issues. We don't tell them exactly what we're going to look at, but we'll ask our members to vote on issues so they can say, we would like you to look at, the moment we're looking at housing and homelessness in Scotland, so they can say, we'd like you to look at this. We've previously done big investigations into fracking on the back of requests from our members as well. And so that's another way of doing it. So I think it's quite, I think there's various ways. What I try to avoid is, and I had this when I worked for Channel 4, is one of the reasons I stopped making television programs, was the channel, I remember the channel telling us what they wanted us to investigate. And not because they had any huge lead into anything, but because this is something that people will watch. You know, this is an issue. This is an, you know, it's about a big name company. Why don't you go and investigate them? And that's the problem, I guess, for a lot of like kind of broadcast media. There's a desire to look at companies because people have heard of them, to get viewers. Often viewers are seen as a kind of a register of success for TV programs, even if it's an investigative program. And that I try and shy away from. I try and shy away from like saying we're going to look at X unless there's a good reason to look at X. You know, I think that's the danger. The danger is let's try and look at this thing, but even if we don't actually know what's there, if there's any real reason for it.
Yeah, I often wonder what is going to happen to journalism if there is this constant focus on analytics and 100,000 people will click on this story about Kim Kardashian, but hey, actually this story over here that 10,000 people clicked on is still really, really important, and how news organizations are going to manage that as it goes into the future.
I think it's a huge challenge. Yeah, it's to if you focus, you know, to take that example of investigative TV programs, there's kind of, you know, the main metrics you have are viewers or awards. And, you know, awards are going to be something that you're only going to have a few programs that you're going to want to put in for awards. You know, you're going to have a lot of just kind of meat and potatoes programming that's not going to be award winning. It's not going to be an in-depth investigation into ISIS or to child trafficking networks around the globe. It's just going to be, you know, the kind of work that I think RT actually often does very well, you know, stuff like illegal dumping, things like this, which are important bits of journalism. They need to be done. They're probably not going to win you a bunch of awards unless you find out something completely heinous, but they're important. But the problem is, that kind of journalism doesn't generate huge viewers, really, generally. It doesn't, and it's not going to be award-winning. So for TV channels or whoever else, they're going to go, well, actually, why should we do this? But you're right, there's a huge reason to do that. You know, there's a huge reason why you should focus on issues like that. You know, say, take illegal dumping. It's something that's a health risk. Well, what's going on? What are the processes around this? What processes aren't working that this is taking place? You know, there's a huge series of journalistic questions to be asked about that, which won't produce the kind of metrics that any of management might want. You know, you're unlikely to get huge numbers of viewers. You're unlikely to get awards, but the work itself is still valuable. And I think that's a huge question. If you drive everything through metrics, and if you drive everything purely through that kind of that framework, it's very difficult. I even say it, you know, we run the cooperative that I run, the Ferret. You know, there's a question early. You have an audience who subscribe to you. At what point do you do stories that they don't want to hear, they don't like? And I think it's a really big challenge for journalism at the moment. You know, there's a lot. Subscriber media is probably going to become a bigger and bigger thing where people subscribe. If you look at Greenpeace or something, they've got a huge investigative unit now. They've got 2 million members around the world. They do a lot of good journalism. But, you know, how much does what Greenpeace stands for influence what they decide to look at? And it will do. But I think it's important we ask those questions, because often they don't really get asked. We kind of have a tendency not to want to talk about that aspect of why we choose to look at one thing and not another.
And there might be kind of an attempt to shy away from something that, if you think your subscribers aren't going to like it, you don't want to upset your subscribers because they're paying money for whatever that is. So, there is a problem there in terms of funding of media organizations as well, which brings me on to my next question, Peter, because I'm just thinking, we touched on it earlier about how newsrooms are more and more stretched these days, and, you know, they have fewer staff, and that means there are fewer positions out there. So if anyone out there that's listening in wants to become a journalist and are trying to break into freelance work, you've done an awful lot of freelance work. How did you manage to get your foot in the door in a lot of those organizations?
I spent most of my career as freelance. By the end of it, I was working mainly for Politico in Brussels and for some of the American newspapers. My big advice is always, and having taught journalism as well, my big advice is always find out something that you know about and you're interested in. You know, I initially did a PhD many years ago, and actually did a PhD on kind of human.
I should have introduced you as Doctor Peter. Sorry,
Doctor. Yes, I don't use Doctor alone. Is there a doctor in the house? Yes. What's your doctor of? Post agreement Northern Ireland. But I initially wrote a lot on Northern Ireland. I lived in Northern Ireland and worked in Northern Ireland. And I wrote a lot about Northern Irish politics because what I knew about. And that's often a very good way, I think, for young journalists, is to find out things you're interested in. You know, what are the areas that you're actually interested in, rather than trying to be somebody who can do a generalist who could do absolutely everything. And the reality is, the modern media more and more is people who've got specific skill sets, specific interests, writing and researching in those areas, rather than a huge amount of generalism. So I always think that's always one advice I always give people, is to write about things that they're interested in. Figure out what is the areas that they are genuinely interested in, and build up a knowledge base. You know, tech is a great example. There's a lot of great tech journalists who kind of came out who've just been really interested in tech, and then having a communication skill, been able to actually communicate. And that's where, you know, because this became a totally new, you know, 15 years ago, there was no such thing as a tech journalist, really, or 20 years ago, there wasn't really tech. Now there's a whole thing called a tech journalist. And a lot of these people are probably people who were very interested in technology growing up and also have good communication skills. And they've kind of built a niche. But a lot of other journalists, the background, they came out of the newsroom environment where you went in and were generalists, you did everything. You might be on a sports desk, but then you might go into politics, then you might go to something else. And I think that's much harder. That's a much harder route now for journalism. I think more and more it's very useful to find out a speciality in a place that you're really interested in. But the other thing I think is really key for young journalists coming up is this idea of like, well, what's new? Where can you find new information? You know, where can you go beyond? Where can you offer something that isn't just press releases and isn't just something that's already in the public domain? And I think that's when I'm teaching, it's something I'm always trying to kind of inculcate in students, is a curiosity. You know, is this idea of asking questions, well, why is it like that? What's going on? And don't assume. I think there's always an assumption that, oh, loads of journalists would already be looking at a subject, because that's often not the case. You know, as you describe, we're all living in very kind of straightened newsrooms. There's less money, less resources, but there's arguably more work to do than ever before. So in thinking about, well, what's not being done, where can I find new information, what are the core things that I could discover? And I think that's where skills are really, really important for journalists coming up. And I often think I've been quite lucky in that I've been lucky enough to get onto training courses and things like this. I did Dispatches training course, Dispatches training scheme for 6 months with Channel 4, where they took me under their wing and they taught me how to make TV and how to be an investigative journalist. And I think they're quite rare, really, those opportunities, but skills are more and more important, you know, to be able to come into a newsroom and to be able to have like kind of tech skills to use Excel, to be able to number crunch and things like that. So I think it's that mixture of things that's really important. But it's curiosity is the fundamental thing, the thing that makes you kind of want to find out more about a subject. I mean, the things that make you kind of think, well, what's going on here? What can I find out?
Yeah, that's often what I tell to people as well who want to get into journalism. I'm like, you'll need to know. It's not about your own ego. It's about what that person that you're talking to had for breakfast that morning. And you need to just be able to quiz them about every aspect of their lives. I love that I can ask people questions and they have to answer me. It's my favorite part of my job.
If you want to be nosy, like, and the other way, an interest in being nosy. I think it's quite, you know, it's an important skill. I think it's
it is a skill. Thank you.
It is. No, be nosy.
Peter, in terms of the Irish media, I know you're over and back a good bit. What do you think is the biggest problem facing Irish media at the moment?
I think it's interesting because I live in Scotland. Scotland and Ireland are similarly sized. And if, say, go back 15 or 20 years ago, I think there would have been a kind of sense for the Scottish and the Irish media landscapes were pretty much akin. You know, the big newspapers in Scotland, the Scotsman, the Herald, would sell not quite as much as the Independent and the Times, but in the similar ballpark, you know. And on the British kind of paper reviews, the Scotsman might be one of the papers that they'd look at. That's really changed in the last 10 years. The Scottish media landscape has been very, very, very badly hit. You know, you've got Scotsman's newspaper sales are well below 20,000 a day now. Almost no papers are selling in any significant numbers anymore. And there's been a huge amount of job layoffs and all the rest of it. And I kind of look sometimes at Ireland and feel like Ireland's probably where Scotland was 6 or 7 years ago, but the direction of travel is probably going in the same way, which is kind of worrying. I think there's, you know, I think Ireland is still quite well served by some very good commentators and a lot of really good journalists as well. I think there's some really cracking journalism that goes on, whereas in Scotland, a lot of that has completely disappeared. But the problem, I guess, in the Irish media landscape, you know, it's a similar industry-wide problem. You've got, you know, legacy companies with large overheads, often expensive properties, particularly expensive pension schemes, a lot of purchases that were made during the boom years, which are now worth what they were. A lot of salaries that come from the boom years, that again, you're kind of stuck with these on their books. You know, and I think that's the huge challenge for the Irish print media in particular as well. How do you pivot out of that to a kind of more nimble model that's going to be sustainable? And how do you bridge the gap between your print readers, who are older of a certain demographic, and younger people who are online? Like, one of the most interesting things I look at the Irish media landscape, and I look at something like The Journal, for example, and I can never get over the number of hits that, you know, the readership on The Journal just blows my mind for a country of 5 million people, less than 5 million people.
It just shows the demand for news out there.
It's incredible. I did a story with them. Well, Open Democracy did a story, and we did it with The Journal just before the abortion referendum, the 8th Amendment referendum. And it had 60,000 readers, which for Open Democracy is absolutely massive. It's way more than it would have got on our site. And I found that really interesting. Again, that sense that there is a young audience that are consuming news, but it's about how do you produce news in the way that you want, in the kind of format that they would want it. The challenge, I guess, for legacy organizations is that whereas you've got someone new like The Journal, they're able to produce news just for that cohort, or, you know, and they can get older people reading it too, but they're not left with these legacy way of doing things. Mm. Whereas for older players, you're still having to kind of try and straddle both sides. And you see that in Scotland a lot. I think in some ways you can end up with the worst of all worlds when you do that. So I've seen, you know, you see that news organizations attempt to be kind of edgy because they think that's what's important, but actually that can often you can often end up printing terrible nonsense that will actually really damage your brand. And also I think there's the ideas that people are still inculcated with about, like, say, clicks are good. That, you know, if you look at the actual numbers now, clickbait doesn't work. No one's surviving on clickbait.
No,
look,
it's quality and not quantity.
It's exactly. But the problem, I guess, is for a lot of senior editorial staff and a lot of management, I don't think the penny has really dropped across the board with that. And I think that's probably something that's quite concerning. I think in some ways the Irish media is not quite in as dire straits as it is over in Scotland, but partly because of ownership as well. You have kind of quite unique ownership structures at the Times, and also for very, very, very different reasons at the Independent. So that, I think, does feed into it a bit as well. There's a kind of, and this sounds like a silly thing to say, but I also think Gaelic Games plays a part as well. There's a large readership for things like that are indigenously Irish that you can't buy in. Whereas in Scotland, say, a lot of the content that's in Scottish papers, about 80%, I'd say, is bought in from London, whereas most is produced in London. I think in Ireland, you still have to produce a lot of the content within the island, at least. So I think that does mean that there's a market, there will be a market there. But I keep on waiting for the kind of the print kind of truncation to really happen. You know, it's been heralded for about 10 years, but this year already has been quite a bad year for media across the world, if you look at the kind of job losses we've seen. I think it's a difficult news environment for all newspapers, and I think Ireland's probably going to see more truncation in the coming years, partly because I think it hasn't been as badly hit for those kind of reasons I outlined as it could have been, but they're going to come down the tracks. I think it's a very, very difficult landscape for print. And the big challenge is, how do you convert these people people that might buy your newspaper into something, you know, into people who will continue to subscribe online? But more than that, how do you turn them into people that are really bought into your product? And that, to me, I think is the key question. I've been kind of giving a bit of advice to an ordinary Irish newspaper about some of this stuff, family-owned newspaper, about, like, well, what do you do with your readers? You know, how do you turn your readers into something that's more than just a reader? How do you get them to buy into your product as part of, you know, something that it almost becomes something that they self-identify? And I think that's the big key for news organizations now. I think the New York Times has done that really well. I think the New York Times has been excellent at doing that and producing really, really good quality outputs that, you know, like the Daily Podcast and other things that people can buy into. And it's the challenge.
They just have such a massive potential audience, though, in the New York Times, and that's because everyone kind of turns to the New York Times as the answer. But I think that they're so unique in the amount of people across the world that they can appeal to. I don't see how an Irish publication can look to them for any kind of answers.
I think that's true too, to be honest. I think that's a huge challenge. So they're going to be able
like
to
I subscribe to the New York Times, but how many people in New York are going to subscribe to something in Ireland? Very few.
Very few. And that's the big, big challenge, I think, is well, what do you do? How do you, you know, if you're trying to compete in a global marketplace, it's really difficult if you're trying to compete from an Irish perspective with international publications. I think it's a really, really difficult sell. And what can you produce that's going to be, you know, what does your audience, A, what does your audience want in terms of product, but B, what does your audience want in terms of a kind of wider offering? Mm. The Guardian's been trying to do this for a long time, you know, with their kind of Guardian events and things like that. Which I think has been kind of, I think they've got the right idea, but I think they've had the wrong execution at times because, you know, you're talking about a supposedly international newspaper and all the events happen in the Guardian offices of London. I think that's really hurt them. But I think the idea of trying to build people in as something beyond just someone who picks up your newspapers, members, subscribe, as your community members, whatever you want to call them. But this idea of a community, I think, is really important and will become more important. Yeah, and trying to understand what it is that your members want. For example, with the Ferret, we do a lot of public events, which are really successful. We do them around Scotland. We run things like, you know, debates, fact-checking workshops and stuff like this. And it's quite time-consuming. It doesn't bring in, it brings in tiny amounts of money. But I think it's very useful in terms of brand building and building a kind of connection between an audience and a product. And I think that's something, you know, one thing I always look at, I think there's been some interesting developments in Ireland in regards to, you know, the Second Captain's podcast is fascinating, you know, how you've got this podcast that starts off just really talking about soccer and sport and now does other stuff too, but has a listenership, a paying listenership in well into the thousands.
It shows you can have these kind of special, if you have your niche and you have a committed audience, you will be able to succeed. I mean, those guys are doing fantastically well.
Yeah, and I think that really is where the future is going to be, is around niches. You know, I think that's it, and it's about publications figuring out, well, what is my niche? What's the market that, you know, and some of that times the niche can be a demographic as well as a content vertical. Your niche mightn't just be, right, we write about sport or we write about business. It might be about, we write about this all, you know, kind of the full gamut of things, but we write about it from a certain perspective. I think that's what when I was talking earlier about the problem of being a generalist, I think this is a problem for news outlets now, is that they emerge from a world that no longer exists. I recently was given evidence of this, a UK inquiry looking at the future of local media, and the person who was heading the inquiry was saying, look, what we need to figure out is how do we keep the letters page of the local newspaper? And my answer to that was, well, why do you want to do that? Like, why are we trying to build what looks like the future based on what was the past, you know, how a newspaper was laid out? And I think it's very difficult. I even find it difficult, you know, because I grew up with newspapers and I still buy newspapers. Well, how do we...
It's like if you landed an alien in the country or in the world, how would they think news should work now, given the technology we have, without any prior knowledge of what we had previously?
Exactly. Why would they think a page lead should look like that? Why should a story be 500 words or 800 words? Why should it be presented in this form? Why should we have the inverted pyramid? All of these things. I think there's a huge, and these questions are in no way answered. And I write loads of 800 word page leads, and I still write like that. And but I think there is definitely a need to think about how we present information. And I think there's often, less can be more as well. I think the difficulty for a lot of news outlets is in the rush to produce more content, you can often end up producing things that that are sloppily written, saying things that you probably wouldn't want to have said in the light of day, and antagonizing audiences. And I think that's a real challenge. I think there's a huge, you know, it doesn't, the old model, the kind of internet 2.0 model of let's just put up as much content as we can and that's the way we get clicks and that's how we survive, that doesn't work anymore, but it still seems to be the driving logic of almost every media outlet that I can see, especially in kind of smaller nations like Ireland and Scotland.
Well, interestingly, the Times Ireland has kind of gone against that and decided, no, you know what, we're going to have our subscribers there, we're going to update the website X amount of times a day or whatever, and that's going to be it. We're not in this rush to the bottom to get the first new press release out there about the latest whatever. And it seems to be going quite well for them. You know, they are building up their subscribers as well. So maybe, you know, everyone will have their own answer to something eventually.
I think that's it. I think that's interesting. I think, yeah, in the Times, but I subscribe to the Times. I think the Times, and it's done well. It did a similar thing in Scotland, actually. The Times is growing print sales and by a huge amount of subscribers in Scotland as well, on a similar model to what it's done in Ireland in terms of, in Ireland, I think they've built, and I think I'm very impressed with the Times Irish output as well. But they, you know, bringing in new young journalists and having a kind of a distinct place in the marketplace and say, look, we're going to, I think it's only about 3 times a day that the Times is updated. And I think that's been very successful for them. I do think it's about like trying to figure out who are the different, you know, who are the interest groups that we could get to to get behind. I think what the Times has done very, very cleverly is go into markets like Scotland and Ireland, realizing that they've got a background of a solid base of content coming from London, coming from, especially of international content, and then building on top of that. I'm surprised more outlets didn't think to do it before, but in some ways I think the Times has actually probably has cornered that market very successfully. And it's about, I think that's the big challenge is to move away from the idea that there's a magic bullet, which has been the idea for so long in media, that there's this thing. You know, first it was clicks, then it was, and for some people video became the magic bullet, but it's been coming quite clear that that's not the way, that's not the future of sustainable media. Isn't going to be a magic bullet. It's almost certainly going to be, you know, a series of different revenue streams coming from subscribers, coming from adverts, coming from events, coming from, you know, various sources, probably philanthropic donations even to large media organizations, and building an ecosystem, building something around that. The challenge is that's a very time consuming way to make money. It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of kind of energy, whereas the previous model where people just bought the paper and advertisers advertised was really easy. You know, it was much more straightforward, it was much more straightforward editorially. And I think it's, and while newspapers are, and they will be for the foreseeable future, having a mix of, you know, the online offering, the paper offering, still wedded very much to the, you know, imagine if you took away the crosswords from some newspapers, their sales would go through the floor. You know, so there's still, so it's kind of how do you take all these things on together? And I think that's, it's a huge challenge for the industry. But I do think thinking about, well, what's the best, thinking about how do we, what would we want to produce now, given the world we live in, rather than how do we mimic the world that came before, is a much more kind of a savvy strategy.
I think there's a lot of food for thought there, Peter, so we will leave it there and let the listener mull over that for a while. That's all for this installment of the Media Matters podcast. Thanks so much to Peter Gagan for taking the time to chat to me, and thanks to you all for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please share Media Matters on your social media channels, rate us on iTunes, and subscribe. If you have feedback or any suggestions for future interviewees, tweet me on Colette_Sexton. Until next time,